You know, you can always get somebody to redo his postulates. You just change them around for him, but you can always do that. But he now has the power to postulate. And woe betide the enemies this person has, because if this postulatingness continued on downscale below the level where it actually lives, it'd just be the saddest, sorriest world you ever heard of if people at 1-5 could postulate and make it stick. They can't. Or if people at boredom could make their postulate stick. They can't. They can make their postulate stick only above the point where they always keep a bargain. Isn't that an interesting commentary on man? For to make a postulate stick, it almost lays down this is moralizing on what is only a scientific technical scale. If a person could make a postulate stick every time, or change a postulate at will, which we know is the best therapy there is, he would also always keep all of his agreements in all directions, or could undo them when they were concluded. And he would also be able to conceive and behold masses of any and all kinds, and he would also be totally cognizant of any and all lines at will, and he would also be totally cognizant of periods of nothingness over which he still had control. In other words, he'd have the whole of the reality scale in his grasp. I'll go over it again. It starts at the top with a postulate, then a continuing postulate, and then below continuing postulate comes agreement. And we're now just now moving into the finite band, the 4.0 on down, when we say the reality of an object. Those people normally have, from 4.0 down, their greatest reality is that objects are and lines are. And we move from there down to about 2.0, and here we fade on down with a line and less object, you see? Less and less objects over here and more line until we get into the minus tone scale, and there we have lines. Where's a rope so I can hang myself, you know? And then this goes on down to just nothing. And that is the reality scale. And it tells us at once that someone at the level of 0.1, you know, apathy, body apathy, comes around. He says, you know, I've just made a postulate, and the entire government is going to revolt tomorrow. Don't you believe it? That person's postulates don't stick. They get frantic about them, and they try to tell you they do, but they don't. It's quite interesting, quite a fascinating view. It's as though life had its own brakes, its own inhibitions, and it safeguarded its abilities, so that as a person loses these abilities and takes on other attributes, he is fortunate to have lost the abilities from the viewpoint of the rest of us. In other words, an individual had, at 1.5, sure as the dickens, better not have the ability to postulate cleanly and clearly, or people would start dropping dead all over the place. But the way it's rigged, and these things are just basically considerations and agreements amongst the race, the way it's rigged is, by the time he gets down to that point, he couldn't keep a contract. You know, there are some people that if you sign an airtight contract with them, perfect contract that was highly beneficial to them in all directions, you would then and thereafter find yourself at once in court. A lot of people go around saying, well, it's all right if I have it on a contract. Oh, no, it isn't. Not in this day and age. It's all right with the people it would be all right to contract with, you don't have to contract anything. Isn't that interesting? I mean, you really never need it in writing with a fellow that you should be doing business with. Quite amazing, you know. You say, Joe, why don't I let you have $100,000 these so forth, and you can pay me next Tuesday at 3.1 pence. Hey, he says, okay, all right. Oh, my goodness, books get delivered, and there's this tremendous sums of money involved in all directions. Be patient, it's all right. But this other fellow, you say, well, I don't trust him too well, so thing for me to do is to make it all out in a big contract. So you go get a firm of solicitors, and they hire another firm for consultation, and they all sit around the table, and they put down your thoughts and their thoughts. It's all going to be adjudicated in court, and we write it all down, and it's put into very legal language, and then somebody is paid. I think they pay him a sixpence for every extra whereas that they throw in. And we get it all done, and we seal it, and we bond it, and we put it in a vault, and the books still don't get delivered or paid for, whichever one you were standing on. See? Contract doesn't make any difference. In other words, if you have to sign a contract, you're in much better shape not to do business. Businessmen learn this the hard way, and usually with their business associates, a fellow who is really successful in business, with his business associates, he has certain people that he will do business with easily. And it's just a matter of picking up the phone and saying, hey, Joe, how about 320 quid till Tuesday? I'll give you a note on it if it comes to mind. And the fellow puts it in your bank, you know. You say, well, it's against this next shipment. He doesn't say, well, are you going to deliver it? Is it in good shape? He says, well, when will you have the next shipment? And he says, well, I'll have that by Wednesday. And you say, okay. That's the way about 99% of the business of the world is done. Much to the disgust of solicitors, because they get a lot of money trying things in court. Do you see this?
Yes.
All right. All sorts of social considerations derived from this reality scale. What is real to a person? That which is real to a person, he respects. That which is to a person, is. And a person who is below the level of agreement does not consider that an agreement ever exists, even when it is in writing. And a person who is below the level of terminal doesn't believe you exist even when you poke him in the jaw. And a person who is below the level of line doesn't do a thing when he shakes hands with you. He just doesn't do anything. He has not done anything. You say, Jones, meet Dow. He never even wakes up to a point of saying, who is that I just met? Of course he doesn't. He might get up to a point of wondering whether or not he had shaken hands with anyone in the last half hour. See, but that would be a high-toned reality for him. You got this thing taped? Because it's something that needed pretty well, it needed elucidation in Scientology, because we talk a lot about postulates and terminals and communication lines and that sort of thing, but where do they peg on the tone scale, and what is the expected behavior regarding them, and how do people react toward these things? Well, that is the reality scale. Now, right alongside of the reality scale is the scale of effects. And this one tells you whether auditing is auditing or just tomfoolery. It actually is not too intimately connected with the reality scale, but the two influence each other, just as they both influence the ARC Chart of Human Evaluation. Now, what is this scale of effects? Well, stand by for a great big piece of understanding of the human race. When this one fell out of the hamper, I said, oh, no. I said, radiation, here we come. This is it. This tells you the dwindling spiral. It's the scale of effects. Now, as I've been talking to you about the Chart of Human Evaluation, you might have envisioned a great many scales here, a great many lines, and a person would go downscale as he got more and more plugged in and less able to mote. And we could plot the reality scale alongside of that, and the scale of effects can also be plotted on the same type of gradient. But it tells you something entirely different. Not what is real to the person. It tells you the acceptable effect. What is an acceptable effect? And boy, right in this one. The auditor, all of a sudden, when he grabs this one, he says, ah. He said, that's why I've never been able to crack JoJo the dog-faced boy's case. That's why. No. Horrible. Now, listen. If you look in Scientology, the fundamentals of thought, you'll find there a description of the game's conditions. The more plunged in a fellow gets on an aberrated game's condition, an unknowing game's condition, the more he goes toward no effect on self, total effect on something else. The closer and more closely approaches this. You got that now? That condition sets in more and more as the person goes down this scale. Less and less effect on self, greater and greater effect on somebody or something else. So we have two columns on this effect scale, and one is effect on others, and that starts at the bottom. Ooh, you know, just tremendous, big. You know, a person way down on the minus zero scale, his idea of a mild effect on somebody else would be to have four double-barrel shotguns rigged up at once, each one pointing at the person's midriff. Give the person a half a gallon of strychnine and fire the guns at the same time. And he says, you know, he says, that's just about what we should do for people. But then he'd have a pause on the thing and he'd say, now, just a moment. You know, they might survive it. Maybe if we put an electronic field around them so they couldn't get out of that, at the same time we fired all the guns, and we've got head shrinking. Now, that's lower down on this. That isn't the bottom, but that's low down on this effect on others scale. And that, as it goes upscale, the acceptable effect on somebody else is lighter and lighter and lighter and lighter and lighter and lighter until it's not necessary. All right. No effect on self. So let's look at the effect on self scale, which parallels this, and we get down at the bottom. Acceptable effect on self is theoretically at the bottom at zero, and then moves up from no effect on self of any kind to greater and greater tolerable effect. I can stand greater and greater effects, greater and greater effects, greater and greater effects, until we get up to the top. We have a person at the top of this scale. If you took four double-barrel shotguns and gave him a gallon of strychnine and fired the guns off and surrounded him with an electronic field, he would say, whee. You got it? There's where he'd be on the upper scale. In other words, what we've thought about in mysticism and in other places and have spotted, the inability to get ruined, sometimes considered to be granted by one, by some strange god someplace or another. You know, God's on my side, so I can't get my ruddy head blown off. They played that game almost out in 1914. They just, you went over the top this way and you saw Gott mit uns, and you went over the top the other way and you saw God's with us, and everybody after a while said, you know, I don't think he's around. And there went an awful lot of faith and decency in the world, just like that. Misusing a tone 40 for some sordid political end didn't work. So a person feels that this is granted to him or something of this sort, then he'll survive it somehow or another. He'll get through with it. Well, regardless of that, there actually is such a point. There actually is such a point where a person's beingness can be sufficiently great that he becomes practically indestructible. It's a theoretical point, but he is able to tolerate tremendous effects on self to the degree that he is satisfied with little tiny effects on others. Isn't that interesting? Up here, he could stand a tremendous effect on self, but doesn't have to have one, and would be perfectly satisfied with a little tiny insignificant effect on somebody else. It'd be very gratifying. He walks down the street, he looks at somebody as he passes, and that person glances back. You say, boy, this isn't much of an effect. Well, that's a totally satisfactory effect. I'm a little lower scale than that. I walk down the street, I smile at somebody, and I sometimes feel something is wrong if they don't smile back. But this is a terrific enough effect, see? This is big, big effect. All right, they smiled, making people smile. Will and so forth is a perfectly satisfactory effect to be able to cause. That's up here somewhere. You're more or less in that consideration level. You don't have to kill somebody to know that something happened to him. But look, as we get less and less effect on self, as we get less and less effect on self permissible, we get less and less possibility of finding out there'd been an effect on the other fellow. Ooh, look at this. Look at this at the bottom. If it's no effect on self, we could blow somebody up, mop them up, soup them up, kill them, maim them, burn them, and keep them in that order and condition for the rest of eternity, and we would never find out about it. You got that? So your person would never find out if he had rendered an effect on somebody else. Do you got it? All right. In view of the fact that he'd never find this out, we get the dwindling spiral. Because he tries harder and harder and harder to create these terrific effects. And he never is satisfied because he doesn't know they ever landed. So he just tries harder and harder and strikes tougher and tougher. No more and less effect is tolerable on self until at last he gets caught up totally in the overt act motivator sequence. He commits these terrific effects and becomes the center of them. Now, we don't start the cycle all over again. He just spins on in from there on. You got that? What do you think the basic philosophy is behind a man who would have to kill off the whole world with radiation in order to know he had done something? What is his state of case? But the funny part of it is they go down the effect on self scale, they actually become more and more easily manipulated. Now, listen, I didn't say anything about it. Now, I didn't say that you were supposed to go find this guy and simply lead him around by the ear. All I said was, don't be scared of it, because you could. Somewhere down in this range, he is in total hypnotic report with anything that addresses him. He's resisted effects so hard that he becomes anything that confronts him and never finds out about it. And there is the range of your, quote, unsolvable case. A lot of people go around and they have to make these tremendous effects. This is particularly true of some newspaper reporter, something like that, some young chap. He turns in this tremendous story, you know. 8 fire engines came down into Trafalgar Square and they all hit head on and crushed half the police force amongst them. This is the sort of a story that he just hopes that he can come up with, you know. Because this means name on the front page. This is success. Never can he understand. He just cannot understand why it is that every so often on the front page, some feature writer writes a story about a dog is lost. A dog named Patsy was lost at Union Station, was apprehended by the police for sniffing. He can't understand how anybody would ever read this story. He read it and appreciated it, but he can't understand how it got on the front page, because he knows what should be on the front page. What William Randolph Hearst and the early British publishers of scarehead tabloids and so forth. Do you know every one of those papers has more or less failed in the United States? And they still try it. They still try it. The old conservative papers that put a few advertisements on the front page, and the fact that the prime minister was assassinated in the last page under police notices, are still going on. Those papers still continue. These scarehead ones don't. They really don't even believe that the public has to be told things this violently to receive them. They don't believe you have to say things like that to sell papers. As a matter of fact, it doesn't sell papers. That's what's so peculiar. But it is the obsession on the part of the editor and publisher that he must create this tremendous effect. The only terms in which he can think are, boy, we haven't got a story for the main edition tonight. I wish half the world would fall off from the other half. That would be a good lead. But as he drives his audience with these effects, one after the other, what does he finally come up against? He comes up against the saturation point. It isn't that the audience wants bigger and bigger and bigger effects. That's the wrong way to look. That's the way they look from the effect on self over to the effect on others scale. The truth of the matter is people, human beings, thetans, can tolerate less and less and less and less and less. So someday a newspaper comes forward and publishes a whisper and is a tremendous success. The young writer always goes up against this. He thinks the great novel has got to roar, has got to, as you open the cover, a bomb goes off. It's a very funny thing. I never used to write detective stories at all to amount to anything. But every once in a while, some friend of mine would tear in, have to have a detective story of something sort, and I'd write one. But I always balked at writing detective stories as detective stories. So I used to take all the taboos in detective story parlance and patterns and write the exact reverse of the taboo, knowing then that I had a wide open field. Knew then it was original. And one publisher of a very famous detective magazine that used to sell some horrendous numbers of copies unfortunately issued a whole list of taboos, stories he would not accept under any condition. He wouldn't accept a story without tremendous action in it. He wouldn't accept a story without a good villain, so on. Well, that was a setup. To the first one, it was very simple to answer that request. We just wrote a story about the sergeant and the detective with spring fever, and they sat with their feet on the desk and waited for a watch to run down. And at the end of the story, because the watch had run down at a certain hour, they went and arrested the murderer, but you didn't even attend their arrest. A story must have action. Yeah, it's just no action, no motion. He bought it. He couldn't help it. It just went right straight through. The second story, that a story must have a good villain, a rough villain, a tough villain. The murderer was a Pekingese. This was my peculiar method of making nothing out of detective story writers that I think are rather humorous. But anyhow, all of these tremendous effects of one kind or another lead up to this, that the person, if you could get a publisher to publish it, if it ever could get onto a newsstand, you would find tremendous sales in a very unknowing games condition society for a book that started out with, quote, yawn, unquote. It was a nice day. All the other books are starting out, bang, bang, three men fell dead. They don't sell. People don't want to read them. People just publish them. I used to write a great deal for the Washington Herald feature stories. And I used to write, and it was rather a puzzle to me. This fellow, name was Mike Flynn, since dead. He was the editor of that paper. I was going to university at the time, and I used to wander around town every once in a while with a camera or something like that and write a feature story, and he'd pay me a few bucks. It was quite amusing. One way of getting through college, so you didn't have to attend class. Anyway, every once in a while, I'd notice these things on the front page. And the stories which I, at that time, didn't think should ever have gone near the front page were very wisely put there by Mr. Flynn. And the stories which I was sure were banner headlines always appeared under obituaries. I just had it completely backwards. I thought you had to make a big effect to make the front page, just like everybody else in Hearst's organization thought, and a tiny effect should go between. Wrote a story one time about a streetcar rails were being torn up and wrote their history. And they started out with a horse car. So I wrote the history of the horse car, made the front page. Never could understand why I received 283 letters in response to that silly story. Incomprehensible. If you'd covered the death of the president, you wouldn't have gotten one. See, I mean, so here's this backwards thing. Now, I'm not saying that an auditor here and there is trying to make a tremendous effect to find out if he's audited the preclear. That would be a critical, meaningless statement because it isn't true. But it is true that the preclear starts to get well when you find a tiny enough effect that he can accept. And therefore, a regular, smooth technique which doesn't particularly shake him up, that will permit him to find that an effect is at last acceptable to him, will bring him right on up tone scale. And those are the control processes and why they work. They are such a tiny effect that a person can accept them. We've been trying to go for broke on these cases that resisted everything, when we should have been trying to find the small enough section of ascent, the effect that they can really receive and know they've received it and admit they've received it, is so infinitesimally small that we as auditors will have to do an awful lot of mopping around to discover it. And that is modern auditing. And that's mainly because we have the reality scale and the effect scale. And you'll find both of them very useful, and I'm very glad to have found them for you. Thank you.